respect and information is what you get from the Progressive Radio Network and Warrior Connection. Hey, we got an angel on our program today. She's been with us before, and she's helped other individual veterans all over the place. And we've heard from these veterans who've come back on the show and saying, this is an angel. This angel helped me get the information out. This angel helped me get out of the darkness. This angel helped me find out that the rest of the world is out there and I can march forward. Charisse, welcome back. Angel Charisse, welcome back to Warrior.
Thank you.
Ray, you want to take lead off on this today? Because you've been working with these people that Charisse has pulled out of the gutter and turned their life around. I mean, it can't get any better than that, does it, Ray?
No, I don't think so. I admire what she's doing, and you know, these others that are working with her, they're doing a good job, and I applaud them.
It's very rewarding. I love what I do.
Well, it's neat when you make a difference.
It makes a difference.
Well, hey, tell us all about the Writing the Wellness program and everything and what you do, and today is your show, totally, Charisse.
Thank you. I guess I should start off by saying that I'm an Air Force veteran, and I myself, I'm working on PTSD and other mental health issues, and I'm a peer support specialist, and myself and two other veterans brainstormed a curriculum for Writing to Wellness. And what makes our curriculum or writing program different than most is the fact that we are veterans and we created it for veterans as well. So it's unique in that.
That's pretty exciting.
How many people do you have in your program usually, or even in a year's time, how many people do you see, Charisse?
Right now I have somewhere between 80 to 100 veterans in my entire peer support program, and I have different groups that I facilitate, and I also do one-on-one appointments as well. But my writing program was meant to be a 9-week program, and the first group I started with, they weren't ready to be finished and hadn't met their goals within those 9 weeks, so I'm continuing on with them, as well as next week I begin another group of veterans. They're just beginning a new writing workshop.
Well, I can tell you this from experience, because I know some of your students, or I'm not sure what you call them.
Veterans.
Students, I guess, or patients. But they have such an addiction to you and the program that I told one of them one time, I said, it's like the little birds, you know, they grow, and then they start getting larger than the parents, and the parents are like, how do I get them out of this nest? And sometimes you have to put thorns in the thing to get them to get out and fly on their own. But you talk about close to 100 people. If they can get them out there and they can reach another person or more people, that's a lot of people, Charisse. So,
it is,
you know,
And that's what's happening. When we started peer support within the VA, veterans were reluctant. They joined because their provider basically told them to do it, and they just, you know, they came, they tested the waters, and they're all hooked now. So they're constantly telling people and bringing people, and to be honest, there's not enough me to go around, so I need some help here at my clinic. But it's a great program, and when I began it, I never imagined that it would make such an impact on the veterans that I serve. I'm just speechless when it comes to that. The goal of the program, when we intended it, was to provide each veteran a voice to share their recovery stories in detail and with clarity. And Ray, your wife, Laura, she talks about in your book, The Never Ending War, about how you were not able to express what you were going through and how she felt so helpless. And my writing group and program, this is what it's about, to get those veterans speaking and sharing their feelings and letting others know what they're going through.
Well, yeah. I think all three of us, Doug and yourself,
vocalize what's happening. We've all been there. We've all done that. We got the T-shirt, and we hold it in forever and ever and ever until all of a sudden you hit a crisis point. And if you can get out there and talk about what did I see, what was involved, what did I think at this time, what did I understand? And then with that and under coaching, as you've been doing and what we've heard over and over again, the individual can vocalize what it is, and all of a sudden the clarity comes in their mind. And that horror from the past, I get, how did he put it, Ray, in the hole, deep in the hole or the well or something?
Well, you know, it's a little room in the back of your mind, basically. And it could be described in a well or anything else, but you feel the depth of it. You feel the darkness of it. And you don't want to share it with anybody because you're embarrassed of it sometimes. But people like Sharice and hopefully on this program, too, is we get people to understand the only way you're going to get help is you've got to crack that door and trust somebody enough to take them in there with you.
Exactly. And how we analyze that is that we tell the veterans it's like stuffing a closet. You stuff the closet, you stuff the closet, and pretty soon you can't close the door anymore, and it's going to pop back open. And when it pops back open, that's when your life really starts to fall apart. Because a lot of times we go through life and we just hide it in the back of our heads and try to forget about it. And then it comes out in different ways for everybody. Some it's substance abuse, other it's eating, isolation. Our electricity's going off. Are you still there?
Yeah, we're good.
Okay. We might lose the connection. Sorry.
Think, you know, that thing hiding when it goes off, and there's no timetable on this. I mean, a veteran can come back from a combat engagement or whatever he did, or just a simple deployment or training exercise or whatever, and nothing could happen. And then all of a sudden, a few weeks later, it can boil over, or years later it can boil over. But I think this is a key, what we're learning out, and Sharice, I think what you can explain more to anybody, it's down in the subconscious. It's in the soul.
Exactly.
And so at some point, your soul's going to say, okay, what did I do and why did I do this and what did this mean and what's the reality of it? I mean, for Ray and I in Vietnam, this is what we believe. For Desert Storm, this is what I believed. And all of a sudden, I find out, whoa, the truth ain't quite what I was told or understood. Now what am I going to do?
You know, Doug, I think it's one of the things that I suffered from for a long time, unresolved, but it was really about unresolved frustration and what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. But it's also about, I talked about it in the book, when I began to think back to an episode or something of that trauma, I would sit there and relive it. It was like a movie, watching a video, and I didn't want to cut it off. I wanted to see how it ended. And you get caught up. They say if you forget your past, you're destined to repeat it. But if you dwell on your past, it will rob your future. And it really was.
Yes. And those moral injuries and just PTSD itself, they have wounds so deep, they take away your identity, your sense of morality, and they deteriorate your personal relationships. You begin to self-condemn, and you're not able to forgive yourself, which is really bad because the punishment that you bestow upon yourself is just, it's bad. And like you said, you just relive it over and over, and you live in this circle. Your life is in a circle that just goes round and round. It's the same every day. Feeling shame, not forgiving, staying awake, and just reliving it over and over. And that's what's good about this writing, is that you begin to detach yourself from yourself, and you're putting it on paper, which is giving you something concrete, so you're detached. And you can stand by as an objector and read it over and over again, and not see it as yourself. Does that make sense? So,
well, it does. One of the lies of it is that you can live with it and not affect your life, but it does affect your life. And
exactly.
Another one is that we're the last ones to really recognize things about our own self. When you mm-hmm. write, and you began, I know with me, I wrote it 4 different times by the VA therapist. But each time I wrote it, I added more details until finally I began to see all the anger and the bitterness I was mm-hmm. dealing with that I didn't even know was there. And so it does bring out all of the darkness out of that closet. When
exactly.
you unload that closet, you're amazed by mm-hmm. what's inside that closet.
Yes, that's so true. And the other good thing about it, I'm sure you and everybody else, it helps you track your triggers, and soon you're realizing what triggered you. And because a lot of times my veterans, they tell me that they'll just blow up over some little thing and they won't realize what it is. And you got to get to know yourself and know what your triggers are and learn to live in the here and now. And that's the good thing about writing. The writer is offered the ability to edit and censor, and they can write it all without sharing it with anybody and just process what happened. And pretty soon they'll sit back and look and realize it wasn't my fault, and they'll be able to share with other people,
sure.
just get it off their chest.
You know, another good thing about your program, Therese, is that it's group therapy.
Exactly.
And with a group therapy, you get to hear what others are saying. And many times, it may be just one or two things or one or two words, but they resonate with you. And
mm-hmm.
it helps you to find out some of the triggers that are causing them problems.
Yeah.
That you began to, identify with it and think, that's one of my triggers. And
mm-hmm.
so you can avoid them many times. But even if you see them coming, you can be better prepared for them when they do come.
Exactly. And that's what makes my writing program, or our writing program, so unique, is that we're all veterans in recovery working together. And we start out with writing prompts that barely touch the surface. And as they go on, they become more recovery-oriented and progressive. So in the beginning, it's like superficial, just scratching the surface. And that's where the veterans, they begin to loosen up and trust one another and realize that, hey, we're all in this together. And then as the weeks progress, the writing becomes a lot more difficult, and they're really having to reach down deep inside themselves. And then that's where they have each other to support each other. And it's such a feeling to be in the room with them. The power of the support they give one another, it's like nothing I've ever seen before.
I remember when
one of the things that you find about trauma many times, and tomorrow I'll be at Camp Lejeune talking to a group that's never been to combat, probably. These are men and women that have been raised in trauma at
mm-hmm.
home through, a lot of divorce and marriage and divorce and things, and alcohol, drugs, other type of things. So it doesn't really matter the battle or where the battle
exactly.
is. It's the effects of that battle that seem to touch everybody's life.
Mm-hmm.
So, there's no big I's and little U's, because
exactly.
trauma is caused by adrenaline. Or the
mm-hmm.
problem that I have is with adrenaline.
Yeah.
And so when something shows up as a trigger, my adrenaline starts pumping, and I go into a panic attack.
Yeah.
That's the way it works for me.
Mm-hmm.
So, I guess we all have something to contribute to that. But, my triggers may be different from yours, but the effects of it is still the same.
Yeah, and I like what you said about we all have trauma, and that's one thing that I like about the group that I have right now, is that there's an equal amount of women to men, which is something that's very rare in the peer support world. We tend to have women's groups and men's groups, but every chair that's filled, each person is unique in the trauma that they went through. And in the beginning, they all thought that each other wouldn't understand, and they were so afraid to share their feelings, you know, just from embarrassment and shame. And now it's amazing. They're all talking. They all talk to each other, and they share. It's very unusual for, like I said, for men and women to be in the room together doing that.
Well, that's what creates the surface. That's what you have to be careful about.
Where you don't want to show your weakness at any time.
You get them to a point, they can go out and begin to do the same thing you're doing, only they don't get paid for it.
But
the tendency is to camp out where you are, and as the circle as it grows and you become more comfortable talking about it, you don't want to hunker down, and you don't want to just isolate, even with people sometimes. So we have got a lot of valuable stuff, you and Doug and myself, because we're able to reach out to people who are hurting. And I think many times you have to hurt yourself before you can reach somebody who's hurting.
Yeah, and that is so true. And, you know, what I've heard from a lot of my veterans, specifically to Vietnam veterans, is you went through all the battle that you went through, and as soon as you stepped back onto American soil, like, you're starting a whole nother battle, you know, just basically you guys from Vietnam, the hatred of the Americans, the way they treated you when you got back, but then also that inter-battle with the trauma and the moral injuries that you're living through is really overwhelming. And
I think it caused a lot of isolation. Doug came back and went right back to college and started moving forward, but I'm sure he felt alone many times just by his past experience. What would you say, Doug?
Well, that was the thing, but I was really lucky. In our physics group, those that graduated, out of the 10 that graduated, 8 of us were Vietnam vets.
Oh, you were lucky.
It was a totally unique thing, and an Army sergeant that was in our group, majoring in physics at this time, he was a squad leader with Cali. And we've had that discussion on my land, this radio program, in the past. So you're talking about the worst of the worst, and he lived through it, and he came back, and he got through his degree and excelled in everything and went on to a productive career, as far as I know. I think when you're writing and starting to write, Charisse, everybody's writing ability is so different. Everybody's vocabulary is so different.
Exactly.
How do you teach or train or get somebody? Because what the three of us can do and what I can do when I'm writing, and what Ray can do as a professional writer now and everything, a lecturer, that's a lot different than somebody that's starting out that's never written before or never spoken before in public. How do you break through that wall, or what needs to happen here?
Well, I think the most important thing is day one when they walk in through the doors into my group, I make sure I tell them, look, this is not about spelling, punctuation, grammar. This is about you. And what you write on that paper is strictly confidential. You can share it at your level of comfort. And I think that breaks the ice quite a bit, you know, when they realize, oh, I don't have to be an author or, so to speak, like a college grad or whatever. And over time, myself, like, I really have a hard time expressing myself and talking in public, and just continuing to practice. And I mean, some of them, I have one person who, my goodness, they went for like a couple months without talking, and suddenly they're expressing themselves and they're comfortable. And I think it's just about feeling comfortable and participating at the level of comfort and knowing that it's okay. It's okay if I can't.
Yeah, well, you know, the words, it's not the great words, it's the depth of what you're writing, really, that resonates to people.
Exactly.
I mean, you know, when I wrote my book, I don't know if you noticed this or not, but my wife's name's on the front of that book, LM Clark, And, you know, when I was getting ready to write this thing, it was really the first thing I'd ever written about Vietnam like this. And I was writing it more in the language of the way we spoke and different things like
yeah.
that, which are not really great. I mean, a lot of improvement could be done. But I told Laura, we were talking about it, and we were working on it together, and she got a chapter in there about the wife of a patient. But I said, look, she said, well, why don't we put it in my initials? And that way, if they don't like it, they'll get on me. And if
yeah.
they do like it, they'll get on you. And
mm-hmm.
I said, that sounds good to me, man, because I ain't, you know, I lost my guts in Vietnam. And so it worked out pretty well. The only thing is I haven't had any one person that didn't like the book too much. And he was actually one of the men in that book. He said I didn't talk enough about him. But
yeah.
It's been incredible the way the journey. It's not the best written book in the world, but the story is so people resonate with things. And though their combat was different, it takes you into the dog-eat-dog, angry, dirty trauma that sometimes we're in, although it may not be in that particular setting, but it's still, when you've been traumatized, it is the worst moments of your life, and you feel threatened, you feel like your life could end any minute, and it's got to be a nasty fight going on. And I think sometimes the way they write it, I've read much of Doug's, Tim's and Doug's also, but it's the depth of what they write that is so revealing.
Yes.
You know, I had some time ago, and this was, I met a Cherokee shaman from North Carolina. Ray, that's where you're at, North Carolina, right? And this Cherokee
right.
shaman said, when you write or you speak, come from the heart.
Yeah,
right.
Come from the heart, because that's where it's all held there. And the wisdom of that Cherokee shaman was so incredible, because that shaman was saying, if you open up your heart, you're going to open up your mind. If you open up your mind, the healing is going to start to take place, and then we can move forward. But if you're not coming from the heart and you're trying to hide something, you're trying to, whether you're ashamed of it or you don't want to share it or it's so horrible that you can't talk about it, it's locked inside. And I think that's where some of the other ones that
have
read their pieces, they said it opened up the heart and everything now is healing.
Exactly. And that's how it works. I mean, just opening up, and it just helps you to share, get things off your chest, and start thinking about it. I think the most important thing is you can begin to forgive yourself.
You know, when I wrote my book, I've joined writing classes. I did a lot of things. But I found out that the average book only sells around 250 copies. And people ask me sometimes, they said, have you sold a million books? And I said, no, definitely not a million books. We've sold a lot of books, but not a million books. And they said, well, I thought you had to sell a lot of books. And I said, no, I'm on PRN FM radio, Warrior Connection, and I do some work at Camp Lejeune and other bases and stuff. And they said, I guess it's not how many books you sell, it's how many people you touch. And I think
exactly.
that is the real value of writing sometimes. You may not make $1 million on it, but the people that you're able to touch through revealing your own pain is like, you know, is priceless.
How can we get this program? I mean, you've got the program where you're at, Charisse,
mm-hmm.
and it's been adopted in other places.
Yes.
But how can we get this as a nationwide program? Are there other people being trained out there or learning how to run this or picking it up? What is happening nationwide?
Nationwide, Fernando and ourselves, we gave a nationwide webinar on it, and those are voluntary, but we had maybe 100 people on board with that. And then since then, word is just getting around. And, like, I just trained some peer supports from California who started their writing program this month. And the VA holds peer support conferences. And Fernando, one of the co-authors, he's going to be at the peer support conferences and when they get approved financially for that. But he'll be offering workshops on it as well. And I, you know, it's just word of mouth. People will email and call and say, can you train me on it? So it's getting around, it's spreading. And besides us as peer support specialists, we have here at the Durham VA, we do have recreational therapy offering our writing to wellness program as well. It's different, though, because mine is peer-to-peer, and that is more occupational therapy-based. But if there's an author, Tracy Crowe, she's a Marine veteran, and she wrote a book called On Point, A Guide to Writing Your Military Story. And in that book, it basically takes you through for easy writing prompts and builds you up to writing your military story. And that's a good resource. If anybody can't find a writing program to join, they can get that book, and it's a self-help book for
What's
writing.
The book's name again and the author?
The author is Tracy Crowe, T-R-A-C-Y-C-R-O-W. And the book is On Point, A Guide to Writing the Military Story. Tracy, she actually came to this writing group and spoke to them. And she does lots of free workshops to military veterans. So I'm not going to speak for her, but she might be a person to have on the show sometime as well.
Well, but, I think it's a...
Do you have time for me to read read one of the veterans' works?
Absolutely. This show is yours completely.
Okay. One of the co-authors to the curriculum, he's also a peer support specialist. His name is Aidan Olid. A-D-A-N-O-L-I-D. He wrote this little thing called Boots. As the snowflakes have come and gone and the puddles in Albany sing their swimming song, I can't help but reminisce of the passing days. Weather brings special attire in New York. I must wear my boots, my Iraq boots, City of Fallujah boots, boots that I wore in battle, boots with mileage higher than my 2007 Dodge Ram, boots with my dog tags interwoven and hugging my laces in the event the Reaper rips me apart. Boots that have been baptized and fermented with the blood of my enemy. My vehicle stuck in the snow like a fly in a web. I was prepared for the 30-minute hike to the hospital that chose to pay me to work for them. 10 floors above the Albany dirt is where my locker finds its home. I unlace my boots and replace them with hush puppies. As the day comes back to an end, I return to my boots. My right foot takes priority. Then comes the left. My hands grasp onto the laces like a Venus flytrap latches on to its tasty meal. The laces go up towards my lips as if they wanted to kiss me in gratitude. The smell climbs up using the oxygen in the air as support and strikes my nose. I smell Fallujah all over again. I smell the dust. I smell the blood, the guts in the mud. The time that I spent my late teens in the middle stages of the second decade in my time here, it all comes back to me. I cannot escape it. Every day I have to go back to Fallujah. Every day I cannot negate it never happened, nor can I negotiate with it to abandon me. The average soul, fearful that it may never get to love nor receive it, nor will it be what it is meant to be, but my soul holds on to its past. It is the only thing nobody can ever take from me. It is all I have, and I will happily take it with me to the grave. Aidan passed away last year, and he was part of a program called Songwriting with Soldiers, and what that is this company, they bring veterans to their location, and they have workshops. They help the veterans to write, to write the trauma that they went through. So it's kind of like a writing program in that the veteran shares what went on in their life, and then they have producers come and help them get it out on to paper and make it into a song. The name of Aiden's song was I Couldn't See the Sunshine, and Aiden lived in California, and he was struggling really bad, and he walked up onto the Golden Gate Bridge, and he was ready to jump. Somebody came up and talked him down, and that became a journey with Aiden, and like you did, Ray, he traveled from California to New York. He took his time. I think he told me he took like 30 days, and he just wrote and found himself, found his whole, and he found happiness. And that's where what inspired him to write this song, I couldn't See the Sunshine. Aiden became a peer support specialist at the Albany VA, and he got sick of pneumonia. That's what took him. He didn't commit suicide, but he had this song, and what's really, really sad is that the day the song was released is the day that he passed away. So, you know, I just want to take some time and honor Aiden right now, because I know that wherever he is, his spirit is continuing to help soldiers through this program and through the songs that he wrote. And if you want to look up Aiden, it's AdanOllid and Songwriting with Soldiers, which is a wonderful program to you veterans listening. It's free and it's paid for.
Awesome.
So you can go and have your story put into a song.
That's awesome. Yeah. Awesome. You know, when you were saying that, when you were reading that poem, I thought about that thing that I do in my programs, and we talked about it one time, is I, at the very beginning, I get them to hold a, like a 8-ounce bottle of water in their hand or something, whatever it is, and I don't let them support it. I just get them to hold it out, and then I talk to them, and after a couple of minutes, I'll ask them, how much does it weigh? And they'll say, a lot more than it did. Well, it doesn't, really, but the longer you hold it, the heavier it becomes. And I think so many times, the quicker you can get to people and try to get them to understand what's going on and get them to maybe even write about it, the better off they're going to be. They don't have to keep holding the thing. They can actually let it go.
But the other problem
we
have
with
acceptance.
Oh, I agree with that.
Is when you're sitting there accepting, you had this belief all along, and it's sort of like the veterans all get together, and we've all been there, done that, you know, sit there, drink a six-pack of beer or whatever, shoot the bowl, and whatever's happening. So the acceptance is in that bond that you have of common thing. But then also the acceptance comes about, well, you're going to hold the status quo, or this is what the belief is supposed to be, or this is where it's supposed to be understood.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get down deep into the moral injury part, and you're going, wait a minute. This doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
And I think that's where the moral injury is so ripping everybody apart together. But if you can either vocalize it through a song or get it into writing through your writing program or any way that you can get it out in the open.
Yeah, I mean,
you got to accept it. Are the vets willing to accept what comes out of their soul when they start this, or what's the transition that happens there? It's got to be very, very difficult.
I hear from my veterans that it is very difficult, and they kind of retreat back a little bit, and eventually they just keep writing like you did, Ray, and it begins to make sense. I know the processing is really hard, and that's why we call it creative writing, is that the prompts aren't write about your trauma. we have different prompts and how they express themselves, each of them is differently. I wish I could sit here and share all of the writing and see how unique each person's writing is. Everybody expresses it differently, but the important thing I want to reinforce is that they have each other. They have each other sitting there in the seat beside them, and they're there to catch each other when they fall. So I think that's one thing that all of us veterans have in common, is that we tend to trust each other, and we find it hard to reach out to non-veterans. At least I hear that all the time from my veterans.
The other thing, too, with the veteran, we see this happen to Vietnam veteran, the current one.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to talk about it. So they go through that portion where they're in denial, or it's in, I'd say it's more incubation than anything.
Yeah.
So it's sitting there incubating.
Mm-hmm.
And they're hiding it or disavowing that it happened, even though it's a major portion of their life and it's had a major impact.
Yeah.
So you have the psychological impact, and as we all know, all too often, we have the physiological impact. In other words, there's real underlying injuries here. There's a real underlying illness. There's a real underlying wound here. And then all that's going to affect and compromise what you can do and how you get through things.
Yeah.
I think with Vietnam, one of the things that bothered me, Doug, when I came home, and Charisse, is the fact is that most people didn't want to hear about it.
Yeah.
They disassociated with it. They didn't. They were like, just forget it. We don't care about it. We don't want to hear about it. And what it did, it drove you into a closet, really. And I live in a military area. North Carolina is heavy military. But still, when I came home, it seemed as though people I worked with and people I associated with, they just didn't care to hear about it, because it was like going into Disney World and telling people what a bad story, and it's like, oh, man, you're wrecking my day. Don't tell me nothing bad because I'm having a good time here. And that's kind of how I felt about it.
Mm-hmm.
When you get around other people in a setting where everybody has identified with some kind of a trauma, now you can open up to them. Now you can, once you feel comfortable with them, you can, I guess the hard part for you, Charisse, would be getting the first person to become honest. Because then it grows.
And that's why we start superficial and work our way up with our writing prompts. It takes a lot of trust for them to sit there and speak with each other. And that's the same for all of my peer support groups. I'll have veterans come in and they'll hide in their hoodies, like, have themselves so dressed up in clothes with their hats on, and you can just see them sinking down in their chairs, feeling so uncomfortable. And I mean, some of them, each of them has a different amount of time that it takes to trust and open up, but eventually they all come around in their own time. And it's amazing. In my regular peer support group, how far one of them went. I mean, they went from that way, just isolating themselves, and over a year's span became the president of the mental health clinic for the Durham VA. So to me, that's amazing. That's amazing strides to take.
One of the groups I was with when I started, you know, getting into the VA is back in 2002, I think. I went to Salisbury, which is a VA hospital, and I was in this post-traumatic stress group, and they would divide us in like six veterans to a group. And I remember we were telling stories about, they would do it in a process before or growing up, and then before Vietnam, and then in Vietnam, and then after mm-hmm. Vietnam. But we were talking about before Vietnam, and I was telling them my history. When I was born, I was born into a family of, it was actually eight people at that particular time,
mm-hmm.
and there was nine later on. But what it was, my parents were both alcoholics, and we lived in sheer poverty. And I remember there was some African-American Marines soldiers with us, and I remember one of them saying after that, they called him Big John, he was a big guy, And he said, you know what? He said, I grew up my whole life thinking that white people always had a pristine life and they had it made. He said, I've never heard a story like that before because it identified with him.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing.
Yeah.
That bond you develop, I mean, I'm still in contact, and just a few hours ago, I talked to my best friend. I mean, we enlisted together back in 1980, and we'd worked together in the civilian world from before that. So, I mean, we've been best friends, and when we got deployed together. When we got called up for an emergency response together, I mean, we were doing it. And no matter where it was around the world, it's one guy you could totally rely on.
Mm-hmm.
And the neat thing about that military bond is we don't even have to talk to each other when we know what we're going to do and how to do it. It comes natural.
Yeah, that's right.
And, you know, it's funny you brought that up. Last weekend was my father's birthday. He's a Vietnam vet, and he's so quiet. He just kind of keeps to himself off in a corner. Well, his friend from the VFW came over for the birthday party, and they sat like next to each other, and they never said a word. And I kind of laughed to my mother after they left. I'm like, wow, you know, they're friends. And it was really funny because the next day his wife called and said how much she enjoyed the party. And I'm like, it's funny because they never said a word, but they connected. And
sometimes you have to talk.
And you know, Ray, your wife talks about how you were alone and how you contacted all of the people that you were deployed with and how they kind of led you into the VA where you began to get help.
True.
And that's peer support. It's peer support and how it works.
You know what? And one of my buddies told me one time, he was about the only one to ever been to the VA, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So he was the one that started everything with these guys. But what he said to me, he called me one day and we were talking, and he said, Ray, you really need to go. And I said, I don't want to go because I don't think they're going to do anything for me. And he said, I'm telling you, they will. But then he said something to me that changed everything. And he said, it's nothing wrong with asking for help when you need and deserve it.
Yeah.
And that made a big difference in my life.
And a lot of...
Because I came to realize that I needed help, and
yeah,
my pride or whatever was not allowing me to do that. So I had to reach out. And one of Doug's friends up there is Chris, and Chris has been on the radio program a couple of times. But, you know, it starts without reaching out, trying
mm-hmm.
to find help.
And that's what's important to veterans out there who may be listening, is that you don't have to have physical wounds. And a lot of the ladies out there, a lot of the women from Vietnam and before that thought that they weren't veterans because they were females. So if you served, you're a veteran. And for family members out there, I wish that Laura would have had this resource when she was going through things with you, but Coaching Into Care is a hotline. You can Google it, Coaching Into Care. It's a hotline that connects family members and helps them help get the veteran into care, because a lot of times the veterans, they just don't want to go. And a lot of them don't even think anything's wrong with them. They're just like struggling with addiction or whatever, isolation, suicide, ideation, all of that. And the Coaching Into Care hooks you up with a provider, and they will help you get them into care. So it's a wonderful resource. And it is all VA providers that are on the other end of that line.
Therese, don't you think it's a little paranoia with veterans that, because what it is, they're trying to protect that little piece of their life
mm-hmm.
that they don't want to share with anybody, but they spend a lot of time thinking about it.
Yeah.
But I think they feel almost violated or threatened to become open and transparent with somebody.
Yeah.
And so I guess the first thing is to get them over the paranoia of saying, you've got to reach out, because there's a lot of people reaching out for you, but you've got to reach out to them.
Yes, and there's a lot of the younger OAF, OEF veterans out there who are going into government jobs, and they don't want that. They don't want to have that stuff on their records.
That's right. That's
a big issue as well, is not wanting to build a paper trail.
Explain that a little bit more, please.
When you're a government, when you're active duty, a lot of the veterans, while they're on active duty, they don't even want to start receiving the care then because of shame from, you know, their platoon sergeants or whatever branch they're in, especially a lot of the SF soldiers and stuff. They don't want to share what they're going through because they, you know, there's a lot of stigma behind it, and they don't want to appear weak. So they don't get the help while they're on active duty. They're going out into the civilian world, and due to the jobs they have, there's a lot of government contracting jobs, GS jobs that they want to get hired for, and they're just afraid to have that on their records, you know, in their medical records, that they have a problem. So, I mean, that creates barriers for a lot of people out there as well, just not wanting to have that negative stigma behind them. Because when you go to them jobs, and there is a misconception, because when I got this job and when I worked at Fort Bragg, nobody checked my medical records. So, I mean, it could be different for other jobs, but that's a big barrier as well with a lot of veterans.
Right. Well,
I know when I went on active duty the last time, director of the DU project, and everything, obviously we were physiologically already hampered substantially at that time. But you're in there with these young kids, and at that time, I mean, I was in my 40s, late 40s.
Yeah.
And you're up there with those 18 and 20-year-old kids. Well, they're running, jumping, leaping, running all day, doing all these things, and you're coming up there, well, hey, yeah, I'm going to use my brain and all this stuff. But no, I can't run with you. Well, all they saw was a senior officer in a uniform, didn't see anything else, and they couldn't tell the age. Well, that guy's in a uniform. He's out there. He ought to be able to do the same thing with us. Well, I could no longer keep up with a 20-year-old than I could keep up with a 50-year-old.
Yeah.
And yet I'm sitting right there in the middle of it, and that look on some of their faces is just really weird. And then when we opened up and they heard the story, or they were willing to listen, or we had to teach them in order to prepare them, it was like hitting a wall. Oh, my God, this is what's going to happen to me, or this is what the possibility is. This is what I have to deal with. It's almost, in Ray, you come back to us if you're living in fantasy land.
Yeah.
And that breach and everything come forth, break out of that fantasy land, come into the reality and write it down. I mean, there's no doubt it's healing, but, man, I just can't. The depth and the difficulty of doing that is huge.
Well, Doug, you know, they used to say there was a little boy in church one time, and he stood up, and his father put him down, set him on the pew, and he stood up again, and they put him down again, and the little boy was looking at his daddy like he was really upset, and the father said, "Now you sit there." He said, "I will, but in my mind, I'm still standing up." And I think that's the attitude sometimes, is that part of me that was so messed up, and what I do is I almost feel proud of it. I feel proud of what I've done, proud of the people, and it's almost like eulogizing over somebody. We always paint them into a better picture, and we feel like, I don't want to let people know what I'm thinking. Matter of fact, one of the things I did was I burned all or threw away all my pictures from Vietnam because I didn't want anybody to see them. I didn't think they deserved to see them, because the way they treated and they talked.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned that was a mistake. So what do you think about that, Charisse?
I think you're absolutely correct. And a lot of the veterans, we term it as wearing different masks, where you have different masks for different people in different situations. You just kind of hide behind it and just put on that happy face or indifferent face. And
true.
You're just back there.
You know, but at the same time, that happy face is on there, and it happened to me, and we've talked about it, and it's happened to all of us.
Mm-hmm.
Then that trigger intervenes.
Yeah, and you're probably not even happy behind that mask. You know, it's just, I mean, you might be, but I hear a lot of veterans, like, they go to family events, and they really don't want to be there, but they just put on that mask. And like you said, they end up getting triggered and leaving.
The thing about a mask is, though, Sharice, and I'm sure you identify with this because mm-hmm. you work with people, is that you can put on a theater mask, but you can't disguise your eyes. And you can look mm-hmm. at a person's eyes, and they may be laughing, but you see the pain in those eyes.
Yeah.
Or you see the discouragement or the depression in those eyes. You can't. And I know I recognize it with a lot of people. When I go into a setting at Camp Lejeune somewhere, I can look around those people around that place, and you can actually see the pain that they're going through their eyes.
Yeah.
They may be laughing, or they may be cutting up,
mm-hmm.
but it's still there. And
yes.
A facilitator, as many times, has to be able to see that,
mm-hmm.
to understand it's a fake, it's a mask.
Yeah.
One of the things I tell them in the moral injury thing is
I
talk about
a different term for it,
peeling back the what is it? I can't think what they call it now. The what you put over a table to make it look like oak. It's actually pressed wood.
Oh, a veneer.
Yeah, about peeling it back.
Mm-hmm.
And in our own lives, we have to peel it back sometimes. So I think you're probably doing that.
Sharice, you're a female Air Force veteran.
Yes.
How was that received, or what is it looked at you coming today when you're getting there setting up to help the people, and if you reveal or don't reveal that you are a veteran yourself, is there a reception, or is there disbelief, or is it, oh, my God, I can help you, or is there a time lag involved in all this, or what happens? I mean, this is going to the personal stuff. You as a female veteran, I mean, that's totally different. I mean, it's not the same for Ray and I. We're all totally different.
And you know, even when I served on active duty, I was in a male-dominant field in 1985, and I was not received well. You know, being female active duty was hard, but then stepping into the world of the VA, and not only was I a female, I was Air Force, and you know, everyone thinks, oh, that's nothing. But also my age compared to the majority of my veterans are Vietnam vets. So there was absolutely no trust whatsoever. And in the beginning, like, nobody trusted me. I knew it. I felt it. And they looked at it as coming to socialize with each other versus me. And I could see, you know, over the last 3 years, we've really developed bonds. And I have veterans come up to me now, and they say, well, you're all right, Sharice. In the beginning, I didn't trust you. We didn't trust you. But now you're amazing. And, you know, they just really, really trust me and want to be part of my group.
Well, I know you pulled Tim out of the depths of hell. He told that story on this radio program here just recently.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's, you know, when you have an individual comes on to relate where the individual was and what had happened and how it all improved their life through the peer support and the writing, the wellness, and then you listen to his story, you just start smiling. You feel good all over.
I do, and I think that what has helped me connect with the veterans is I'm real. And I share my own experiences, and that builds trust because they know, wow, you went through something similar to what I've gone through. And that's what peer support is all about. We're on the same level as our veterans. We're not here to serve them. We're here to go through it with them.
That's true.
How do we get the doctor to understand this? I mean, as I told it, Ronald's my best friend and my sergeant. We've been together forever and ever, and all the worst of the worst. And we got a call last Friday from the chief of staff that our doctor had boogied on. So all of a sudden, we got our whole team under that's left alive under one VA doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden, they're gone. And now we're still struggling, and I was struggling right before we started to pre-record this. Okay, do I have a doctor, yes or no, and how do we educate them, and how do we get them to understand where we're at? And the fact that the opportunity is you're responsible for a crazy team that doesn't exist,
yeah.
That does exist. How do we get the doctor to understand what's happening? I mean, they were brought up in their whole different society, whole different culture, whole different education, whole different experience.
Yeah.
And then the vet comes in there and then to the depths of, yeah.
To be continued. I think that just being open and they've not walked in our shoes, but they have walked through pain themselves. And I mean, we've all been through difficult situations.
Well, we're out of time. Charisse, can you come back on the radio program again, please?
Yeah, sure.
You've been an angel. God bless you. Thank you for everything you've done. Ladies and gentlemen, Charisse Marsh, U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs, Director of Writing to Program. Thank you, Charisse. God bless you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Charisse.
Bye.